Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the April 2nd edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an economist, the host of the Capital Record podcast, the author of Full-Time Work and the Meaning of Life, and of course, he's founder of the eponymous investment firm, The Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. Good to be with you, even though cross country.
Yeah. Well, soon to be rectified, I hope.
You know what? I actually have to spend a lot of time in California this month. I go back on Sunday, and even though I have like a little 3-day thing to my Oregon office, I'm actually in the Newport office for like almost 3 weeks, which sounds like hell.
I hope your staff are not listening.
Do you think anybody has ever done a podcast for 7 years about a state that they've grown to hate more than I have?
You love it.
I love it. It's a love-hate relationship. That's why we do this. It's a love-hate.
It is why we do this. And speaking of being in and out of offices, next week on, I think it's on Wednesday in Newport Beach, and then on Thursday, maybe I got the dates wrong. Anyway, it's the last day of April and the first day of May. I'm going to be joining National Review Institute and a bunch of other really nice speakers. They've got Janice Rogers Brown, who you may remember from the California Supreme Court, a former Governor Wilson appointee.
And on the board of the Calvin Coolidge Foundation, handpicked by my dear friend Amity Schles.
Oh, my gosh.
Amity and I were just talking about Judge Brown today, as a matter of fact.
What were you saying? Because
You can ask.
Will you answer?
No.
All right. We'll also have NRI's Lindsey Craig, National Review editor Rich Lowry, Ramesh Panuru, editor of the magazine, brilliant guy, UC Berkeley law professor John Yu, and yours truly. Let's put registration details in the show notes. There's a link there where you can go and you can sign up. There's I think, nominal charge. But again, that's next week in Newport Beach and San Jose. Dates and details in the show.
Not next week. It's April 30th.
What do I have? I'm sorry. It's April 30th. What am I saying? I'm so sorry. Yes. Thank you for clarifying that.
Because I think a lot of people would have shown up and just camped out for 3 weeks.
Absolutely.
When a new iPhone is coming out, or like a new Star Wars movie, except for it's Will Swaim coming to the Pacific Club.
That's right. And people dressed up in cloaks and helmets and laser things. Yes. Last day of April, first day of May, Newport Beach. And thank you, San Jose.
What do you think reflects more mental instability? Someone who would camp out for a few days for a Star Wars movie or for Will Swaim?
Look, I'm self-interested. I'm just going to say. Star Wars. I'm just going to guess.
That's weirder?
Less weird, yes. I've had way too much coffee. Can you tell?
No, you actually seem kind of down a little, a little low energy to me.
Sorry about that. David, lots to get to today, and I want to start, and I hope nobody will accuse me of the sin of pride, but it's my piece in National Review, and it's about former California Labor Secretary, now Joe Biden's acting Secretary of Labor at the Federal Department of Labor. This is Julie Sue, of whom I'm speaking. Of course, we've talked about Ms. Sue constantly over the last many years in her role as California Secretary of Labor and then in the Biden administration. A recent memo that came out of the Department of Labor, the Federal Department of Labor, would forgive California's COVID loans from the federal government in 2020, 2021, would forgive all of those loans and just let California basically just keep moving ahead, despite the fact that the person who lost those loans and is forgiving them is one and the same, Julie Sue. The news, and I think part of what was so interesting about this was the news was actually buried in the state's 2022 annual comprehensive financial report. That's a financial document that is supposed to be filed annually on time. This one came in, David, 15 months late on March the 15th, 15 months late. And it's supposed to just tell you what the finances are. In that report, however, the California controller says she's not really able to come up with a final number because there's this matter of an outstanding obligation to repay those COVID loans, about $30 billion plus, give or take a few billion. And she doesn't know whether we're going to actually owe that money because of a memo from the Department of Labor. You go and look up this memo, and it's called DOL, like Department of Labor, 0524. And it says, I'm just going to read it to you, it required that the loans required states to use CARES Act funds for the purpose for which the money was paid to the state and to take such action as reasonably may be necessary to recover the United States all benefit amounts erroneously paid and restore any lost or misapplied funds, etc. Bottom line, COVID hits in 2020. The Trump administration signs off on the CARES Act. Billions go flowing into employment offices in states all across the country. California immediately loses most of its money, David, in a story that you know too well, to international crime syndicates and other fraudsters, including people in California state prisons. Julie Sue was overseeing,
which, by the way, syndicates, crime syndicates, state prisons, along with state government and federal government, the former category may be the morally superior actors in this.
Yeah, there is truth in your humor, David. In part because, you know, just not just because of the double dealing that Julie Sue is now at the Department of Labor and has this tin can tied to her tail. That is the fact that she lost this money. But the fact is that she was warned about this in real time by the state auditor, which had been telling the Department of Labor for years, up to and including Julie Sue's tenure, that it was vulnerable to this kind of hacking and fraud. And Sue ignored it in large part because she said doing anything to raise the barriers to applications for unemployment benefits would hurt the marginalized communities in California, the most at risk. And so rather than implement even reasonable checks on who was applying for unemployment loans, or rather unemployment benefits, Sue just let the floodgates open, shoveled the cash out, and then we lost billions and billions of billions of dollars. Now, the Department of Labor memo that I cited at the beginning here says that all that's required for the loan forgiveness is for the states to assert that they have done the best they could to find this money and say they can't do more. Well, California's already done that, and so what we say here, what we see here in the financial report that I cited, is a state controller saying that California is, quote, waiting on final federal approval of EDD's request, as indicated in the February 2024 letter. So that's the long story, a little bit like finding a tape on the door of a, you know, on the lock of a door in the Watergate Hotel leads to bigger and more terrifying things. This weird little memo from Julie Sue to Julie Sue, effectively saying, California, you are forgiven all your sins. Go ye forth and sin no more.
Yeah, your focus here is on a lot, not entirely, but largely on how they should have known it was coming. They should have been more prepared. They were warned. There was incompetence that allowed the fraud to take place. I think you're right on all those points. But my question would be, what if they were just plain victims of fraud, and, you know, they did what they could. The fraudsters were smart. And it isn't so much a story of incompetence. I still, for the life of me, don't understand why the citizens of Tennessee or Rhode Island are supposed to be paying for California's issue. Regardless of whose fault it was, California got that money. California lost that money. And when we say the federal government is now going to swallow it, what you just said is 49 other states are going to swallow it.
That's correct. Yeah, and I make that point in the story, but thank you for amplifying it, because it's really...
This is outrageous.
Yes, but this is classic California to blame shift and then shift responsibility, not just blame, but responsibility for the error to some other states. So, you know, this is something that I talked a little bit about on radio the last couple of days is after the story went out. So some of our listeners may already have heard that. But the point really is, as you say, David, that this is a way for California to escape responsibility for its sins by making others responsible for the paycheck. And we see this in all kinds of California legislation. Reparations is one of those. And I think of immediately because I work on it so frequently, where, you know, people who did not commit a crime are punished for, you know, in order to repair the damage done to people who did not suffer the original crime. So I'll put that story in the show notes. David, in other news, there was a fun fact check in the news. And I love these because the fact checks the media applies to major news stories are often as riddled with errors as the original statements they investigate. This one is from the Sacramento Bee, David Lightman, the reporter. The headline is, California Senator LaFonza Butler boasts win for crime victims fund despite less money for the state. So in an original statement, LaFonza Butler, our listeners will remember that she replaced Dianne Feinstein in the U.S. Senate. Gavin Newsom's appointee there. And Butler's just a kind of a manager of the seat. She's an interim. She announced pretty quickly that she would not be running for the office. We've covered LaFonza Butler in some detail. But the issue that Lightman has with her recent statement is that she says that she secured a win for California and cited as one of her achievements $1.3 billion for the federal fund to help crime victims. Lightman adds, she failed to say the funding is not a win, but a steep drop from the funding of the previous year and the year prior to that. And her claim, which implied that all the money would go to California, was perhaps misleading as well. The $1.3 billion will go to crime victims to help crime victims across the country. California will receive some of those funds, possibly between $80 and $100 million. What he doesn't go on to say, Lightman, is that the money doesn't go to victims. It does not go to the victims of crime. See our previous conversation about other taxpayers paying off California's failures here. This money goes to nonprofits, David. Nonprofits which say they're helping victims of crime, but it's not clear which victims of which crimes. It's not clear that these are actual victims of crime or people who are at risk. Lightman's own story refers to the Genesee Center, a nonprofit domestic violence intervention and prevention center in South Los Angeles. That's one. He points out later in his own story that lawmakers have been warning of the consequences should the fund continue to be depleted. Rob Bonta joined 42 other state attorneys general last month, warning in a letter to congressional leaders that if the fund continues to shrink, quote, many victim service programs across the country may be forced to close. Again, David, this looks to me like money shifting, a slush fund. The money comes in from fines and penalties associated with federal felony convictions. Then the money goes into this account and is delivered to the victims of crime. Now, you would think it would be restorative justice. The money would go to the victims of those perpetrators. It does not. It goes into this massive slush fund, which the Congress then doles out to the states, and the states then dole it out to local nonprofits, most of them progressive and aligned with, in California, Governor Gavin Newsom and the Democratic supermajority in Sacramento. So it's just one more of those weird ways in which something that sounds important, like, you know, victims restitution, just becomes a slush fund for government.
Corruption.
Corruption. Okay, so here's a story I wanted to ask you about, because please remind our readers, listeners, wrong show. Please remind our listeners, you were deeply involved in the music scene for a while back in, what was it, the 90s, I think?
The 1890s, but yeah.
You and John Sutter and the Soggy Bottom Boys. So there's a story here about Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Buffy Wicks, an Oakland Democrat in the state assembly, has crafted a bill right now that is going to make Ticketmaster pay. She wants to, this is the story from Laura Corte at Politico, a state lawmaker wants to end exclusive control by companies like Ticketmaster over the sale of concert and sporting tickets.
Oh, stop. Please. What's wrong with that sentence?
The state lawmaker who wants to end the exclusive control of companies?
By companies. Like Ticketmaster.
Like Ticketmaster.
If you have exclusive control, how is it a company like Ticketmaster? Isn't it just Ticketmaster?
Nice point, editor. Well done.
I'm just saying grammatically, they're already undermining their absurd thesis.
Well, right? It's really, yes. And it's fascinating that you point that out immediately. And I'm sorry that I missed it. Shame on me. Well done. Because deep in the story, the reporter says something very much like that. It's in here somewhere and I'll find it. that it is, in fact, that she refers to, the reporter does, she refers to the chaos around Taylor Swift. I didn't follow this whole story, but apparently Ticketmaster and other ticket agencies that were selling tickets for Taylor Swift's massive tour apparently screwed up in some way. There was too much demand, not enough tickets, and there was some chaos.
You're kidding me. You know what? When the private sector makes a mistake like that, there's only one person to call. I'm not kidding here. You need to get an Oakland Democrat to fix this stuff, because at least then you're getting the A team. You know what I mean? The A team of prized professional excellencies. The person in charge of running the most cockamamie city in the United States of America. That's who's going to fix a mistake going on with the computer processing of tickets. That's who's got the complexity and sophistication to unpack the accounting and the logistics of a private sector ticketing error is Buffy frickin' Wicks of Oakland, California.
Well done.
Buffy Wicks would not get hired to volunteer at a cafeteria in the real world. And this person is going to lecture us about what to do when there's a mistake with Ticketmaster. The consumers and the company and the managers and the venues and the stakeholders can't get together and figure this out. It's so funny how many stories you go through that are pretty much infuriating, and I usually don't get infuriated. And this is the kind of story that makes me want to rip somebody's head off.
I'm glad to provide the service.
Dear God.
Ms. Wick says, quote, "We want to make sure that we have competition and choice for consumers so we don't end up with situations like the Taylor Swift concerts, like Lord of the Flies attempts to get tickets." Yes, just like Lord of the Flies. You already raised this, David. There's so much that's wrong about this. But one of the things is, why in the hell is government getting involved in a system in which we are not required as citizens to participate at all? I am not required to go to a Taylor Swift concert. Therefore, do not think the government has a role in determining whether or not I get tickets and whether there are fees associated with that ticket and whether the price is too high or too low or whatever, where my seat is, anything. It just infuriates me that the state that is unable to do almost anything, as you point out, wants to get involved in how tickets are sold.
So she thinks that there was a big mess with the Taylor Swift concert.
Yes.
Well, you know what she needs to do? She needs to calm down.
Did you just tell a woman to calm down?
No, I was quoting a Taylor Swift lyric, Will.
Oh, sorry. I didn't know
that. If you weren't 130 years old, you would have known that.
I do know Shake It Off.
But I did it because I am 49 and kind of in tune with what the young kids are listening to these days. Okay, so you understand that Ticketmaster doesn't have a monopoly, that there are other ticketing agencies.
There are.
There are other venues, that there are other concerts, that there are in a secondary market. And the reason I know this is I go to shows all the time that the tickets are done through Ticketmaster, and I end up having to get my tickets through Ticketmaster, but because I don't want to deal with, what did you call it, the Lord of the Flies? I think she's talking about going to the DMV in Oakland, but okay. So she thinks it's chaotic to get tickets in the primary market through Ticketmaster. But of course, groups like StubHub and a number of other secondary market ticketing agencies are able to process ticket orders after a show is sold out that then ends up running through Ticketmaster, but isn't part of the Lord of the Flies. But again, just at the end of the day, to put this thing to bed, the idea that a city council person.
State assemblyman.
I'm sorry. A state assembly person based in one of the worst run cities in America would have any opinion at all on how tickets are supposed to be sold to the public of a private concert event. I'm not one of these weirdo libertarians. I'm just not. I never have been. This is Orwellian, nannyist absurdity. Like, you can't come up with 500 things that the government should be focusing on more than this. And when you do focus on it, you can't even get the facts right or understand what really went wrong. It's just crazy. And then they want to bar them from restricting the reselling of tickets. And it's pared down. So, I mean, you read this article, pared down so severely, it lost the support of the Consumer Federation of California. So you just, I don't even know for the life of me what is driving this. Like, I can't, usually I could say, okay, this is stupid, but I don't get mad because there's some obvious political angle, you know, the gamesmanship. What's the politics of this?
Well, I think there's two things. Number one, it's just the ongoing and generalized full frontal attack on all fronts, I mean, on business in California. This is what the politicians do. It used to, what was the old saying, that patriotism is the last refuge of scoundrels? I think it's class warfare. And that's what this is really about. It's about a hatred of a very successful business. And the history of Ticketmaster, by the way, is fascinating. I started going down the rabbit hole on this. I'll spare you the details for the moment.
You remember Ticketron?
I do. You, wow. That's, you know the story off the top of your noggin?
I do, but go ahead. You go. Because it was more your era.
So, indeed, what's fascinating is I do think it's part of that whole attack on business. And this particular front that she's working on is the one that is suggested by all kinds of folks on the left, that the real enemy of American consumers is the hidden fee. Remember, Joe Biden came out and said, my God, you go to a resort and they ding you for parking. They ding you for the pool and the spa. This was a major concern to him, that people were going to resorts and being hit up for hidden fees, he called it. You and I pointed out as soon as that came out, and as soon as Rob Bonta and Gavin Newsom jumped on the bandwagon of hidden fees, that the perpetrator of real hidden fees that attack Californians every single day is the government itself. Gavin Newsom keeps playing the phony claim that what's really at stake here in California with high gas prices is not government regulation, which adds more than $1.18 in the price of gas in California, but a mystery surcharge. The mystery surcharge is government fees and regulation. That's what accounts for the difference in gas prices in California and everywhere else in the country but Hawaii. That's it. But making the hidden fees argument against business requires you to protect your flank, and your flank is government is constantly in the consumer pocket.
Well, that's right. So the hypocrisy of it is outrageous. But the difference, of course, is even worse, because the private sector is they're not, you know, when you call hidden fees, I mean, there's some fees are easier to find than others. And I, you know, have built a business around my belief in transparency of fees. But the Ticketmaster fees are a byproduct of private sector transaction and people, you know, choosing to get information or not. And I have my own opinions about what I would do if I ran Ticketmaster, but it is still private capital. What you're describing is not only the hypocrisy of the kings and queens of all fee hiding, but they're hiding your money. It's public money that they are stewards of. So not only are they just completely guilty of the thing, egregiously more so than the thing they're accusing others of, but they're doing so with capital that doesn't even belong to them.
Well said. So just really quickly, as I understand it, the deep history of Ticketmaster is that Ticketron, its predecessor, which it soon acquired after a quick change in business strategy, Ticketron came out and its deal was that it would charge the venues to sell their tickets to consumers. In other words, if there were fees, they were charged to the venue. So if you were at the Staples Center, which didn't exist back then, Ticketron would charge the Staples Center to sell its tickets to the public. It was providing a service to the venue. Ticketmaster comes along, and the guy who is their CEO at the time, brand new to the organization, I think this is in the early 90s, if I'm not mistaken, is a guy named Fred Rosen, who says, no. We should cut deals to become the exclusive distributors of tickets for these venues, and then we'll pass along the charge, the service charge, to the ticket buyer. Our client, Ticketmaster and Fred Rosen realized, our client is not the customer. Our client is the venue. The customers are paying a fee to buy the tickets from our customer, the venue. So it was just a flip in the business strategy that had Ticketmaster suddenly line up a lot of these venues, but not, as you point out, not only Ticketmaster, but all kinds of other ticketing agencies out there have followed this model quite successfully. So anywho, let's move on to Sacramento, where the city council voted unanimously to become a sanctuary city for transgender people. This, of course, precedes by just a few days President Biden's request that we all observe Easter Sunday as transgender, I think, Transition Sunday or something. But in any case, in Sacramento, the city council last week voted to make the city a safe space for transgender people from all over the country. It was the announcement was filled with all kinds of predictions of the utopia that people would find when they got here. This is more than just protecting the people who live here in Sacramento, said a spokesperson. This is also about protecting people who come here from other communities to ensure that we're not aiding law enforcement activities in their home jurisdiction who may seek to criminalize their quest for health care. So specifically, Sacramento is aiming at people who may be denied, they think, transgender care in their own state. So they travel to California. They should go to Sacramento because this is a safe place that will not work with law enforcement in your home community to stop any kind of transgender activity. So what's interesting is that the same story, and I got to hand it to them, this is from the LA Times, and I don't normally look to the LA Times for phenomenal reporting, but the reporter finds a UCLA professor, Eric Stanley, I'm sorry, UC Berkeley professor, UC professor Eric Stanley of Berkeley's Department of Gender and Women's Studies was unimpressed by the resolution in Sacramento, saying there's a disconnect between politicians' virtue signaling and the experiences of transgender people. He said it's dangerous for politicians to present California as a, quote, liberally safe space that is welcoming to the transgender community without addressing these basic needs. What are these basic needs? At bottom, Professor Stanley says, California is like really expensive. You're telling people to come here from other places where they may be, where the cost of living may be really low, and to settle here in California without addressing the fact that the cost of housing, water, energy, taxes, everything is so much higher here, you're walking these people into a trap.
So did he say these words? Even people who don't know if they're a boy or a girl know when something costs too much. Did he say that?
I think he needs a new spokesperson, David.
Like, do they go to a restaurant and then they're like, which restroom do I use? Also, this cheeseburger looks expensive.
Yes, exactly. Is there a discount?
I don't even know whose side I'm more on here. Those that want the sanctuary city for the transgenders or the Berkeley professor who's worried about price inflation for transgenders from other states. I don't even know how you think this state is salvageable at this point in time. I really don't. When you hear a story like this, you don't just think like we've just lost any concept of sanity.
Sometimes when I read a story like this one or some of the others coming up here in just a second, yes, it is possible to regret that the people who are in charge here are in charge here. And there's always this danger, isn't there, David, that in talking this way about a state that we love, a state that is critical to the United States of America, you know, we have 12% of the nation's population, a huge chunk of its GDP. It's a very, very wealthy place, despite all the problems. That this state is so ill-run that it can run the rest of the country off the rails. And if people doubt that, you know, refer to story number one, in which Julie Sue is, you know, preparing to write off tens of billions of dollars in federal loans to the state of California for mistakes she made while working in the government of California. This is not, in other words, just, you know, grist for the humor mill, or you and I being, I don't know, darkly humorous. It is a warning that, you know, as California goes, so goes in some respects the rest of the nation. Some of our worst policies and worst people end up working for the federal government and crafting rules. You know, one of the things I point out in the Julie Sue story is that were it not for Kevin Kiley, a congressman from Placer County, just outside of Sacramento, that were it not for that freshman congressman, Kevin Kiley, it is imaginable quite easily that Julie Sue would now be not just acting, but in fact, you know, effectively the Department of Labor secretary under Biden with more authority. He has this, again, a freshman congressman has led the fight to stoke the fires in the Senate to keep Julie Sue from moving forward. Yeah. And among the things that really has this guy, Kevin Kiley, really worked up, of course, is Assembly Bill 5, which Sue had said time and again she would not and could not implement, even if she wanted to, at the federal level. And then on March 11th did so, as we described. It's not exactly AB 5, but it has exactly the same impact and the same impetus. It's kill independent contractors so that they're required to go to work in companies that are more easily unionized. It's a union push. Julie Sue did that, and she did it through the Department of Labor rulemaking power. She did it in a way that will affect workers and independent contractors in every state in the union. That's California. That's why we talk about this stuff, because otherwise it why fight it? Why not just move? Well, you move and you're still under, you know, you're still living in the shadow of California. I do worry that we demoralize people sometimes, but I'm not demoralized. You continue to come back here. You started a school here. Your business is based here and or in New York. I think it's,
that's true. I did. You're pointing out that I have to pick if I want to stay in the fight or not. So I can't tell. Are you trying to bait me to move in my school to another city? No, this is all foundational, Will. This is the reason the podcast exists. This is what we believe about the insanity of the Golden State, is that because we care about the state, we want to highlight the things that are going on that are broken because we want it to be fixed. And there's going to be differences of opinion amongst reasonable people at different times as to what it will take to fix it. But there's never been an iota of reservation that what we're doing is showing something to be insane that genuinely is insane, all the while working to correct the insanity. And I think people can fluctuate at given times in their level of optimism about our odds of success. But I don't think there's ever a point in which the sincerity of our desire to have an impact in fixing things is there. But, you know, you get to a point where on a cultural level, that it, not merely the policy side, it's pretty hard for some states to be well governed when they have a lot of people that behave as if they're ungovernable. And I think that this isn't just a California problem, but a national one in a lot of ways, a global one. You're talking about this thing here, the story you just did. This speaks to a fundamental dysfunctionality that's going to take a while to be fixed, and it will not be fixed when it is, because we quit doing Sanctuary City for transgenders, or we pass a price control law to get the cost of groceries down for transgenders, or whatever this person was going to, the Berkeley guy was going to go on to recommend. The culture is broken. And as often happens in these moments, we get given over to our foolishness, where the punishment becomes the crime itself. That's what I believe we're living through.
Well, let me ask you, because I think my question for you is, isn't there something just permanently broken in humanity that ought to wake us up to the impossibility of utopia, the idea that somehow...
But that's not what we're talking about. See, this is a very important thing. Of course, the impossibility of utopia exists. That is a reality. But I believe in redemption, that what is broken in society ultimately gets redeemed back to God, who made the world perfectly. And I do not believe that we get to fulfill all that or realize it. The temptation is to imitize the eschaton, as they say. I don't believe that we get to have the full utopian glory here on earth. But do I believe that we can make incremental progress without reaching utopia? Of course I do. That's why we do what we do. So the notion that we should surrender to the fact that people don't know who what a boy and a girl is intellectually and morally unacceptable.
Yeah, I guess I just always want to guard myself against nostalgia. The idea that, because I one of the reasons I love history is that it comforts me. It reminds me that our species has gone through this before. And yeah. Magnificent people, sometimes a very small number of magnificent people stood up and said, no, not going to happen. And sometimes they died doing this thing. You know, I'm thinking, you know, for whatever reason right now, I'm most notably just thinking about the fact that a 102-year-old, the last surviving service member who survived the Pearl Harbor attack just died up in Sacramento, 102 years old. The guy was, I think he was on the Arizona when it was bombed, survived that, and then became a pilot and flew over 200 missions in the Navy. These were people who decided they were going to stop fascism all over the world. And I know that's a really easy one. But the fact is that, you know, I meet every day with parents or teachers who are standing up to the teachers union. I meet every day with activists in small places and in California and in large places who just will not give up. And those people, hope is a muscle. And that's all we've got. That's all we've got. Hey, let me move on real quickly to two last stories because I know you got to run. Here's the headline from the Sacramento Bee. Berkeley settles lawsuit to repeal gas ban in final blow to dozens of California measures. David, you'll remember there was a Stanford study that came out a couple of years ago that was financed by a climate change foundation worth a lot of money. And this research purported to show that if you use a gas stove in your home, you are exposing yourself and others to cancer. Thus says Stanford, and so multiple jurisdictions throughout the state, many, many cities, including Berkeley, instituted bans on gas stoves. Well, the California Restaurant Association came in and filed a lawsuit against Berkeley's ban. And not only did it win, the decision of the court in this case effectively unraveled every single municipal ban on gas stoves. And the court's logic was, you've intruded on federal authority. So I'm not, you know, I haven't dug deep into this, but it's apparently the Department of Energy in Washington has total authority over energy policy, which itself makes me nervous. I'm nervous anytime government anywhere is the only thing like between us and total chaos. Because what the federal government delivers today, it can take away tomorrow. But the bottom line is this decision blew up Berkeley, or at least, blew, I'm sorry, it blew up Berkeley's gas stove ban and all these others. But what's interesting is that the reporter is so ready to go after the funding of the lawsuit, arguing that, in fact, it was, you know, wealthy business owners and commercial business interests that financed this lawsuit. But she never looks at the funding of the behind the Stanford study, which, as I point out, is this organization is called High Tide Foundation. And I'll just read you from their program notes. They say the High Tide Foundation invests in climate change solutions across numerous sectors, including energy, food, agriculture, waste, and technology. We fund big ideas that can translate into significant reductions in greenhouse gases. No question of where these people are on the issue of climate change. Very political group. Don't know a whole lot about their funding. But the fact is that it is a progressive foundation. And this never comes to the attention of the reporter in the Sacramento Bee or in any other reports that I saw. Every single news story I found on this Berkeley lawsuit, David, focused on the role of businesses financing the lawsuit and big business and millionaires fighting in court to deprive Californians of a safe climate. Not one investigated the funding sources of the original Stanford study that looked at the danger imposed by gas stoves on all Californians.
Well, is that, in your mind, bad journalism or something worse?
It's bad journalism that probably results of ideological blindness.
Yeah.
I really think that's true. Again, going back to, you know, hidden fees and fines that Ticketmaster might impose on us, but not those of government. It is a set of ideological blinders that when I was coming up in journalism, I knew, you know, I was a lefty, a progressive, and I was particularly, I had deep affection for my Marxist orientation. And I got told by Democrats in the news business who were my superiors that I needed to shut up and stop being such an idealist and just look at the facts in front of me. Now, there's a lot of problems with that approach to journalism. We're all blinded by some ideology, but I can tell you these cranky old guys, they were almost always guys, just did not put up with anybody's feces. Like this garbage that now passes for journalism, this would have been shot down in the first contact with an editor. But here's the, you know, Sacramento Bee reporter just telling us that really the only problem is big money on the side of business, not government. The government can't be wrong, that nonprofit progressive foundations don't even need to be looked at. I sent her a note, asked her what was up, and her immediate question was, well, who funds that foundation? I emailed her back and I said, you're the reporter. Check it out. Here's their website. We'll see. So it's a deeply troubling one of our favorite listeners. I say favorite because he does write to us often with really fascinating articles. Asked you and I the other day, or at least me, I can't remember if you were on it, but just asked, you know, like, what's the state? What is journalism all about right now? And I think that's it. You know, the inmates have truly captured the asylum and are now running it. David, last story, if you don't mind, we'll just move on here. Here's the headline. Ex-Caltrain employee and contractor charged with building secret homes at train stations. The story from the Mercury News is a former high-level employee and a one-time contractor for Caltrain have been charged with felonies after being accused of building themselves secret mini apartments inside two Peninsula train stations, all on the taxpayer dimes. Taxpayer's dime, sorry. So these two employees allegedly used public funds and a public building to build themselves apartment, which when they were finally caught years after these things were first discovered, I think it was 2 or 3 years after these things were first discovered by employees who go, hey, what the hell is this apartment doing? And what are you doing coming out of here, brushing your teeth in your bathrobe? It took years for this to actually rise to the level of any kind of investigation on the part of the state. And, It names the two suspects. One of them is a guy now living in Pennsylvania. The other guy is lives in Oceanside. But both of them had built these just really fun apartments inside their offices, basically, in these transit stations. Lots of folks on Twitter joke that, wow, it was really fun to see two people build housing at such low cost. I think the average cost for each apartment was like $25,000. But you can do that when you steal property.
But do we know if they had the CEQA permits?
No, they did not. That's, yeah, you can do a lot of things when you don't have to meet government regulations. Yes.
So they were getting away with murder.
Absolute murder. Not doing CEQA?
You remember the first thing when, you remember John Corzine, he was a senator in New Jersey and also the governor in New Jersey. And he had been a co-CEO at Goldman Sachs. And he got in a horrific car accident, brutal, almost died, got rushed to the hospital, and life-threatening. And the first thing that the law enforcement said was his seatbelt on.
Oh, dear.
And he was in a coma. And I often wondered if when he came out of the coma, they gave him a ticket.
Sorry to laugh.
So I guess I can't open your Mercury story, by the way, because I have a subscription for every one of these little California papers you make me read.
I'm sorry.
But the Mercury one I don't have. So they were doing this thing with the train set and so forth, building their little imaginary homes. How did this work its way into our show agenda? I'm trying to figure out what I'm missing on the
What intrigued me, and a number of things intrigued me, and I should probably have led with this, that the Mercury News followed up with a big story, which is the first one that I read, that showed that all over Twitter, people were kind of praising these guys and saying,
as artists.
Yes, they have solved the problem of low income and affordable housing in California.
Okay, well, I'm all for that. So then are we for everybody building homes with no permits and no zoning and no city council, no entitlements, as long as it, what is the standard? It just can't be your own property?
I guess, yeah.
But if you buy property and then try to build on it without zoning, that's not good.
That's not good.
Yeah. Do you find that part confusing?
I do.
Can you see how I got a little hung up on this?
Yes.
I would be with these people if it weren't for the distinction they make between people who pay for the property and people who don't. If all they were doing was celebrating the deregulatory nature of creating more housing without CECA, then I'd be on board.
Well, it's also, you know, the other thing that interests me here is how long it took once officials, once employees first identified this property, and I think it was 2022, I think it says, that this was first discovered. It's now, you know, April 2nd of 2024, and the termination proceedings, the court case against these guys is only now beginning. Whereas
there's a story in New York, in the New York Times this weekend about someone who went to a hotel, declared the room theirs, and then went to the court, and they've been living there without paying for 5 years.
Yes.
And at one point, they got someone errantly to give them deed to the property.
Mm-hmm.
Another person couldn't get kicked out as a squatter, and the proof they offered that it was their unit was that they had Shake Shack DoorDashed to them, and they showed the address, and that was their legal proof. I don't have to say here the absurdity of this stuff. Does this warrant an intelligible response?
Well, this one annoys me, as I say, because the other thing is just how long it took for state officials to act on this.
Yeah, sure, that should annoy
you. So this is frustrating. And with regard to squatting, I think it just comes back to a first principle. It's the ownership of the property that the United States and California in particular just do not respect anymore. Like, we have the squatter problem. You and I have talked about it, about people who live for months or longer in California homes. We had the CDC during COVID tell landlords, you cannot evict people for non-payment. I know of a guy who wrote to us during that period of time that his home near a base in North Carolina, basically the tenants in his property, while this guy is out carrying a rifle to defend the United States, his property back home has been shanghaied by the Centers for Disease Control ruling that kicking people out of their homes during COVID is a murder sentence for those people. But here's a guy who's expected to keep up his bank payments at the same time.
Sure.
And we see this all the time. It is a lack of respect for private property. It is a lack of understanding the constitutional principle that we are supposed to be safe in our persons and our property.
Yeah. Wasn't there some kind of outrage in the 90s? There was some U.S. citizen that shoplifted or something in Singapore, and they were going to cane him.
They caned. It was a kid. Yes. For caning. Yeah.
I just want you to know, and this is one of the rare moments where I'm not being funny, I'm not joking. I believe we need caning for squatters. And I swear to you, we'll get rid of squatting. I cane the hell out of these people. I'm saying whack them. Bring the people from Singapore to do the caning.
You want a pro.
Outsource it, because this is messy stuff.
Literally, these people.
You got to whack someone with a cane so hard and publicize it. And I don't think you're going to have a lot of squatting going on.
I think literally these people will be unable to squat if you get through with them.
But I'm being completely serious. Caning for squatting by David Bonson.
There we go. New headline for the show. Caning for, just writing it down because I have a quick forgetter.
Caning for squatting.
Caning for squatting. Hey, I want to introduce somebody here to the show, David. I recorded an interview with investigative reporter Chris Bray last week. He has a phenomenal Substack account, and he's here to talk about community choice aggregation. This is something that I think, David, you're going to find really fascinating. Bottom line is, community choice aggregation is a process by which California allows local governments, cities and counties, to take over the local client base of a major utility like Southern California Gas and Electric or PG&E, or you name your major utility in California, to take those clients and their money and take a kind of a, let's call it a VIG on the deal. So the money still, the energy is still provided for by the utility, the billing, the service, you have an outage, you still call your major utility, but your local city or county may be in charge of your account. This occurred to me, David, when I was trying to settle a little billing problem I had with SoCal Edison, and they said, no, no, you don't need to call us. You need to call this Irvine City agency that runs your power authority. Mm-hmm. So Chris Bray has the details on this. And as with so much of the other things we've talked about here, what Chris's real interest is in how these local governments have set up these community choice aggregators, which then generate huge profits because they have almost no cost, David. Again, everything is still being handled by the utility. They're just kind of the go-between that you have to pass. No man comes to the Lord except through Jesus. No man gets his or her energy unless they go through one of these community choice aggregators, if that's what your local government has decided. So, David, here's Substack's Chris Bray. Chris, welcome to Radio Free California. And this is our first time actually seeing each other. I am a longtime reader and huge fan of yours. This is a delight to have you on the show. Why don't you tell listeners who may know even less than I do about your biography, how you got to be the, I think, really amazing investigative reporter you are. And at least for me, you were flying under the radar for a long time. How'd you get here?
Under the radar for a long time because I've walked away from a lot of institutions. I say that I have like three or four different biographies. I say I'm a former soldier. I'm a former reporter, former small town newspaper reporter, former freelance writer, and a former academic. I got a PhD in history at UCLA. And for me, I had a just sort of a long series of moments in my life where institutions that I had started to serve and started to be a part of stopped working and stopped making sense to me. Watching the just flood of nonsense that comes pouring out of journalism, watching the flood of nonsense that comes out of academia, watching the American military collapse into bizarre DEI obsessions and lose the ability to do things like win wars and function. I am now sort of sitting here in my 50s, delivered to no identity. I've been a bunch of other things, and I'm not any of those things anymore. So I'm trying independently to just talk about what the world looks like to me and why it does, and to be as fact-focused and insistently real as I can be. And the thing I love about, the two things I love about writing on Substack, writing online, I was saying this 20 years ago, if you write online, you can show people. You don't have to tell people, you can show people. You can embed PDFs, you can embed video. You can prove your claims. You can say, here's what this bill does. Click here to read the text of the bill. And it's remarkable to me, as someone who has been a journalist, how much journalists say, like, oh, Donald Trump says to inject bleach. But you notice when they do that, that they don't embed or link to the video that would show you the thing that they're claiming. And so I felt stranded for a long time. I felt sort of boxed out of a bunch of institutions for a long time. And now find myself with the power of independent media and the power of being able to talk in a way that shows, reemerging into public discussion. I'm back.
I'm with you. As a journalist myself, I'm about, I think, a decade or more older than you. I came up totally in the print world and was terrified at the onset of the web, the internet. But then quickly came to appreciate the fact that, as you say, you could link directly to the primary documents. You didn't have to report. You no longer had to trust a reporter if the reporter would link to the primary document. You could see what he or she was using as the foundation for an argument. So, you know, I quickly came to embrace that part of it. And even as I sometimes regret the loss of adult editors, you know, when I was coming up, a lot of editors could deceive themselves and their staff and their readers that they were doing a good job. But, you know, for the most part, my experience coming up was that the editors really had gotten there because they spent 10, 20, 30, 40 years as a fact checker, copy editor, in covering the cops beat at the courts, that sort of thing. They had done the basics of reporting. They weren't graduates of journalism school last Thursday, and today they're, you know, newsroom editor at the New York Times. So let's talk a little bit about that. Kind of gets into the subject that I wanted to talk to you about today. And there's a couple of things here that, you know, a couple of themes. One is the fetishization of the credential. We're going to talk about a couple of political figures and how the left has managed in California to create a money machine that, if it weren't so diabolical, would be really kind of awe-inspiring. I mean, it is really remarkable. So let's start with your essay against credentialism. Again, it's on Substack. I'll put this in the show notes for listeners. But you start off this way. You say, the doctor is in. Corey Jackson is the junior Scott Wiener. Now, just quick footnote here for listeners of Radio Free California, Scott Wiener. We have the Scott Wiener watch, so they will appreciate this. Corey Jackson is the junior Scott Wiener, a first-termer in the California Assembly who has quickly made a name for himself by successfully fighting against, hold on for a moment while I sigh heavily, the white nationalist far right and its fascist book bans. Yes, what this actually means is that Assemblyman Jackson is crusading for eight-year-olds to get plenty of books at high school about, and I'm just going to ask parents whose children are riding in the back seat to mute for 1 second or hit fast forward. He's crusading for eight-year-olds to get plenty of books at school about hot blowjobs. There was your trigger warning. Sorry that it came a little too late, like hitting a speed bump and being told you just hit one. But what I really like about this is that it opens up so much so quickly. We're talking about, we know who Scott Wiener is. Now we're being introduced to Corey Jackson and his book ban. So maybe you can unpack that. What is it? Two sentences? Yes, two sentences. Unpack this for us. What's the book ban? Who's Corey Jackson to you?
The book ban was AB 1078, which took centralized control at the state level of curriculum and took away from local school districts the ability to control their own curriculum to prevent the vicious white nationalist right wingers from banning books that are sexually themed and about LGBT themed issues, triggered beginning among other things by the Temecula School District not wanting to use a book that talked about how brilliant Harvey Milk was. And AB 1078, Corey Jackson celebrated AB 1078 with Gavin Newsom as a first-term assemblyman, appeared one-on-one with the governor of the state, bragging about the fact that they'd passed this brilliant law and standing up for an open culture. And I was fascinated. I've been fascinated by Corey Jackson since the first time I saw him speak. But when he did this video with Gavin Newsom, the parts of his speech don't fit together. He said, "It is the responsibility of every generation to making the rights to go on." Like, he can't talk. And if you watch Corey Jackson debating, when he talked about, the first time I ever noticed Corey Jackson was AB 665, which a lot of people, including me, called the kidnapping bill that says that children can leave their homes without parental consent in the absence of claims of abuse or neglect to seek residential mental health treatment. For problems like wanting to transition to gender transition, if their parents object, they can just leave home and go move into a group home. And Corey Jackson in that debate talked about his credentials. He talked about the whole debate was centered on credentials. He said, you know, "I am a doctor of social work. So as a doctor, let me assure you that if a professional such as myself deems that your child should leave your home, that is correct." And an assemblywoman named Blanca Richards gave this talk that I still is one of the most fascinating things I've ever heard. She said, you know, I'm a teacher and I'm credentialed as a teacher, but if my children need mental health services, I know that I'm not credentialed to provide mental health services. So I do not provide those services to my children. If they need to talk about their feelings, I don't have credentials or a license in that. So I do not have those conversations with my children. It is not correct to do that.
Isn't that fascinating? It's a remarkable outsourcing of the responsibilities of parenthood to credentialed others.
I'm very proud to say that I refuse to parent my own child because I have not been licensed by the state. And it just fascinated me. And I, you know, when people say to you, like, you can't argue with me, excuse me, I am a doctor of social work.
Right. Well, tell us, you know, as long as we're here, let's talk about Corey Jackson's, his credential. You have some fun observations about his doctorate.
So I found this to be true for many, many people. And for example, in Los Angeles County, our lives have been shaped in extraordinary ways for the last 4 years by Dr. Barbara Ferrer, who is a very highly credentialed expert. And Dr. Ferrer has been talking for years about the virus and what the virus will do and what we should expect of the virus. And we've all been deferring to her because she's Dr. Ferrer. And Dr. Barbara Ferrer, the director of public health for Los Angeles County, has a PhD in social justice studies. You know, she's not an epidemiologist. She's not a virologist. She's not a medical doctor. So I find this to be true, not just for Corey Jackson, but for people all over the public sphere who say to you, excuse me, you cannot question what I am saying. I am a doctor. Corey Jackson, every time he speaks, Corey Jackson, when he writes his name, Dr. Corey A. Jackson, DSW, MSW. And, you know, calling yourself DSW at the end of your name says you're a doctor. So saying Dr. Corey A. Jackson, DSW, is saying, doctor, doctor, please address me as doctor, doctor. I respect him for holding it to two and not putting in three or four. You must address me as doctor, 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 doctor. But wondering about Corey Jackson's habit and tactic of saying, standing up on the floor of the assembly and intervening and saying, pardon me, but I am a doctor of social work, so let me tell you how we should vote on this bill. I said, okay, what is the nature of his expertise? And I'm telling you this about everyone who says to you, I have a PhD or I have a doctorate in social work or whatever, you have to listen to me. You can go find their dissertation. You can go find their published work. You can look it up. ProQuest Dissertation Express is an easy tool to use. Corey Jackson got his DSW at California Baptist University, which has a primarily online doctorate program in social work. And they don't load their dissertations onto Dissertation Express, but you can find them on the California Baptist University website. So I looked at his dissertation, and it's several dozen pages long. And it's about a questionnaire he wrote, a 19-question questionnaire. I mixed up the numbers there. A 19-question questionnaire that he sent to 25 leaders of community social justice organizations. And he asked them questions like, as an African-American, is your African-American identity important to you? It's a very deep question. And you know, remarkably, people said yes. And so he wrote a dissertation, several dozen pages long. I think the text is 57 pages. And it's this, you know, academic structure of I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you, then I'm going to tell you, then I'm going to tell you that I've told you. So it's sort of the same section repeated over and over again, but with different verb tenses to stretch it out to 57 pages long. And he says, you know, scientific research in the field of social work shows that African-American identity is important to African-American activists. We must move forward in our social justice work with this important research finding in mind. So he intervenes in the public sphere. He says, you know, I know how to raise your children. You don't. I do. I know when your children should leave your home without your consent. I know what your children should read, and you don't know what your children should read. And the basis of all those claims is that he's a doctor of social work based on a dissertation that's several dozen pages long, that's a few cut and paste sections that he repeats over and over again with different verb tenses.
Now, one of the,
so his credentials are a joke. They're meaningless.
One of the things he was able to do with this credential was to launch a nonprofit organization. I haven't had a chance to dig too deeply into this, so I'm not sure, you know, what IRS category it is, 501c3, C4, C6, yeah, whatever. But he's got a nonprofit. You dug into the nonprofit and found a couple of really interesting things. One, it's in, it appears to be in some legal trouble over technical violations of the law regarding filings and that sort of thing. Not entirely uncommon, except in their number. I don't think I've seen quite that many challenges. He's facing a lawsuit, and he's also received a nearly $4 million, I think it was $3.9 million grant from the County of Riverside, I gather, from reading. And you point out, I wish I had the comment here. Maybe I do. Let's see. Oh, here you go. That what he actually did was he brings in a bunch of interns. Now, this is sort of the nature of his nonprofit work. I'm going to bring in student activists. These appear to be teenagers, primarily high school kids, and they're going to get some work in community organizing. But their peculiar form of community organizing is they're going to work a phone bank to make calls to drive voters to the polls to pull the lever for a tax increase. Here's how you write it. See, he helped at-risk youth by mentoring teenagers to work in a campaign phone bank, calling voters and asking them to support a ballot measure to increase property taxes to provide government with more revenue. Corey Jackson's nonprofit corporation converted public funds into campaign funding. And then just in case we don't get it, you add this. Your taxes paid for political operations. Yeah. I find this really fascinating. And I also just want to point out that though I am not an attorney in California, I'm not an attorney anywhere, no credential there. But I do know something about California law, and there is a case called Stanson v. Mott from 1976, which prohibits the use of public funds in political campaigns. It would be very interesting to see how Dr. Jackson skirted this real hard barrier to the use of public dollars in political campaigning. That might appear to be another problem. But you point out how someone can leverage a credential into a nonprofit, which then gets government money, the purpose of which is to fund a political operation to get more government money. I think we used to call this, I have a child in the military who says, we call this the self-licking ice cream cone. It just promotes itself through this kind of circuit of unvirtuous activity. So we could go on with that, but I think what's really interesting there is just, again, that kind of sleight of hand, that ability to turn government dollars into political dollars, which, if anybody missed the point, you know, Corey Jackson's a Democrat. This is a Democrat kind of affiliated or adjacent organization, very progressive. And then you find the same thing in a completely different area. Just days later, your reporting takes this dramatic turn, a deep dive into, here's my notes, community choice aggregation. What is community choice aggregation?
Community choice aggregation is it began with legislation in 2002. Following the deregulation and the deregulation of the electric power market in California and the Enron crisis, the legislature said communities can join together. They can aggregate their community choice of electricity. Communities can join together and create joint powers authorities with joint powers agreements to become electric power utilities and buy their own electricity. So they can choose their own sources of electricity. You can say, we here in Smallville wish to form a joint powers authority with the people of small town next door and create an electric power utility so we can only use electricity from windmills and solar panels. There are all kinds of problems with the idea that you can sort electrons on the power line and use a different power mix than what's on the grid. But the idea was that it would, that community choice aggregation would allow communities to move toward clean power and climate justice and putting a stop to climate change by choosing together through community action to stop buying dirty natural gas and coal-powered electricity. And so communities have begun to do this. It actually, I think very stealthily, I've been talking to people saying, like, do you ever look at your electric power bill? The way that community choice aggregation worked is that it says that once your city government or county government chooses to join a community choice aggregator, they shift your account. They vote to move whole communities. I live in South Pasadena, California. Our city council, I watched them do this, voted to join the Clean Power Alliance, and then voted to switch every electric power account in South Pasadena from Southern California Edison to the Clean Power Alliance. So with a vote of a city council or a county board of supervisors, they can shift tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of customers to a new electric power utility without asking them. And the law says it's okay to do that as long as you give people a choice to opt out. But people mostly don't know, I think, and I can show evidence of that, that they're being transitioned. If you're not paying really close attention to every meeting of your city council and you're not watching everything they do, your city council votes to move you to a different electric power utility without telling you. And then you get a notice with your junk mail that says, oh, by the way, you're a customer of a new electric power utility now. And the bill, and this is, I think this is the tell. The bill says, the bill that created all of this community choice aggregation says that investor-owned utilities, IOUs, like Pacific Gas and Electric, Southern California Edison, San Diego Gas and Electric, must carry and transmit the electricity of the community choice aggregators, must maintain the power grid, must do the billing for the electricity, and must provide the customer service. So when you are switched to a new electric power utility, the bill that you get is the same bill you've always gotten. It says Southern California Edison at the top, or Pacific Gas and Electric at the top. If your neighborhood loses power and you call your electric power utility to get repair service, you call Southern California Edison. The trucks that show up say Southern California Edison on them. You don't know, you have no real way of knowing except that piece of junk mail or watching your city council vote. You don't know that you're suddenly a customer of this totally other agency. And so suddenly, without knowing it, an enormous part of your electric power bill every month is going to a government, to a joint powers authority that you might not even know exists. And if you look at, like, social media, if you look at Twitter, you can see people saying, like, why is my Southern California Edison bill so high? And why are they charging me this separate charge for something called a Clean Power Alliance? What kind of scam is that, that Edison is collecting this money for themselves? So people don't know where their money is going.
So this is fascinating because it looks a little bit like an organized crime activity on the part of the government, where they move into an ongoing operation and say, you know, it'd be a terrible thing if something happened to your business here. So we're going to get a percentage we're going to get a bit of the VIG on your operation here. They offer ostensibly their unique selling proposition, as we used to say in the journalism world, on the advertising side of the building. You'll remember those days. The unique selling proposition or unique value proposition was, yes, but we're able to channelize the varieties of electric generation. So we can find the electrons that come out of coal versus those which come from the sun, et cetera. So that's their unique selling proposition. But what you're saying is they don't really do any of this at all because it's impractical, number one. And number two, all they've really done, therefore, is just skimmed off the, well, not even skimmed, because they've raised your rates in order to collect some cash. Am I missing something? Is there play devil's advocate for me and tell me what their best argument is against that that assessment.
Their best argument is that science is working to find ways to identify the virtue of each electron as it travels through the power line, so that they could only give you the clean, virtuous electrons. There is no best case. There is no argument to make for them. And this the skimming argument, I think, there are two things you can say in favor of that. And one is, I talked about the role of investor-owned utilities in delivering electricity for community choice aggregators, and they do the maintenance, and they do the billing, and they do the transmission, they do all that stuff. That leaves generation, it leaves power generation. So if you look at community choice aggregators, you can ask, so do they generate power? Do they own power plants? Do they own fields of solar panels? Do they own windmills? And they don't. They don't operate the power grid. They don't do billing. They don't do transmission. They don't do customer service. And they don't generate power. They don't run power plants. The second argument about what these organizations are and how they work is go look at their budgets. They're public agencies. They have to give you their budgets. You can find their budgets online. The Clean Power Alliance, which is the community choice aggregator for me, for my service area in Los Angeles County, brought in a little over $1.5 billion last year, like $1.57 billion in revenue. Their total staffing costs were $20 million. Over $1.5 billion in revenue, $20 million in staffing costs. If they did something, if they ran power plants, they would be paying tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars in staffing costs. They would be paying employees to go out and run the power grid and run their power plants. But they don't do that. Southern California Edison transmits their electricity and serves their customers. And the $20 million in staffing costs is for a couple of lawyers to look at contracts and a room full of energy traders to go out and look for energy to buy. And when you tell investor-owned utilities, oh, by the way, we took 14 million of your customers. The power plants that they were buying electricity from, Southern California Edison suddenly doesn't need that electricity because they just lost all their customers. So suddenly there are a bunch of power plants with a bunch of electricity that they can't sell to Southern California Edison anymore. Sure hope there's someone to buy this. And then the community choice aggregator says to the power plant, having taken the customers away from the organization that was using the power plant to sell the electricity, they say, oh, hey, do you have some electric power to sell? And so community choice aggregators buy electricity from other people who do the work. They sell electricity through other people who do all the work of transmission and customer service and everything. They do literally, absolutely nothing. They produce absolutely nothing. They manage absolutely nothing. They maintain absolutely nothing. They have billions of dollars a year in revenue and hundreds of millions of dollars a year in reserves, in cash reserves, in surplus. They bring in $1.6 billion in gross revenue. They pay $1.3 billion to buy the electricity. They have $300 million left over in staffing costs of $20 million.
Now, where does this cash all go?
It goes into their reserves. They're building up bigger and bigger and bigger piles of reserves. And there are 25 community choice aggregators in California. And what they're starting to do is they're starting to say, well, you know, we have a lot of money that we don't need for electric power. We could support, you know, like community organizations, like social justice corporations through grants that work in a similar field, that are working against climate change, that are working to change the regulatory and legislative environment to promote clean energy. So we could start giving away some of this money to people who are working in similar fields, who are working toward climate justice, and they call it electric power equity or energy equity. we can start giving these large piles of money away to people who do activist work in fields that support what we do.
So there's the dark money connection with Corey Jackson, you know, that you take, you use public dollars paying for a utility that doesn't exist, really. You're paying a bunch of intermediaries, remarketers, they're sometimes called in the online world, you know, learn this one trick to reduce belly fat, turns out to be a monthly subscription fee for a supplement. So it's a little remarketing. You're driving customer dollars toward a new business model. And then that money is used to fund. Now, are you saying that this money is already being used in this way for political organizations that carry out climate justice and regulate fossil fuels out of existence, et cetera?
Yes. So far, not in large amounts. So far, if you look at the grants they're giving out $10,000 and $20,000 grants, but they're sitting on hundreds of millions of dollars in reserves, and that money's not just going to sit there. And part of what they're doing is, within the structure of their own organizations, like if you look at the website for MCE, which was the first community choice aggregator, used to be called Marin.
Marin, was that what it was?
Marin Clean Energy.
Mm-hmm.
What they're starting to do is they're starting to use some of their money to do their own climate justice programs. They're doing things like teaching the youth about climate justice, educating teenagers about how to be a climate conscious voter, and things like that.
So by law, you steal is, let's put it in air quotes, but I think that's really what this is. You forcibly acquire the clients of the organized utilities, SoCal Edison, et cetera. You take their clients, you capture you pay for energy at some level, and whatever's left over is money that you bank and then use for political operations, which further enhance not only your own power, but progressive politics more generally.
Yeah. So wow. I want to circle back to something you said, which is that it's illegal to use government money for political operations. And what you'll find is there are organizations all over that do this. And again, when I talk about specific examples, I don't mean to only tell you about this specific example. I mean, go look for this principle in your community. Go look every year at the money your city council gives away in CDBG grants, community development block grants. That's federal pass-through money. Mm-hmm. The federal government gives cities community development money. Go watch where they send that money. The thing you're saying, it's illegal to use public funds for political activity. The very simple maneuver that's used to cover that is, oh, well, this isn't politics. This is survival.
And education. That's the key distinction. Education.
We're working for the climate. That's not spending money on politics. We're working to stop the planet from boiling. How can you call that politics? We're working to reduce gun violence. That's not political. We're helping the youth to survive. So Corey Jackson's nonprofit, like you can look at the newsletters of Corey Jackson's nonprofit on their website. It tells you what they're doing. They're not engaged in politics. They're training teenagers to work in phone banks for campaigns. They're training and mentoring at-risk youth to speak to city councils, school boards, and county boards of supervisors to advocate for themselves. That's not politics. They're speaking for themselves. They're being empowered by speaking to political bodies asking for funding. How can you call that politics? Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this. There's
such
another,
a cynical and such an easy cover.
There's another interesting feature of your story here about the community energy aggregation business, and that is that you actually took a look at the people who are on the boards of these local community organizations and looked specifically at their credentials to operate a utility, which is effectively what they're doing. They are claiming to operate a quasi-utility, even though, as you point out, they don't do any of the real mechanical work of generating energy, maintaining the grid, complying with California Air Resources Board regulation, et cetera. But what did you find when you looked at the boards of these local community aggregators?
Again, I think this is a thing that you'll find everywhere you look for it. And it's not just happening in electric power utilities. It's happening all over the place. The president of the, or the executive director, the staff director of the California Bar Association, who was threatening to take away medical licenses of doctors who question the vaccines, is, or of president of the medical association, is not a doctor. Like, everywhere you look for people running doctors, lawyers, utilities, engineering, they're not credentialed as any of those things. So if you look at the credentials of the people who run Southern California Edison, Pacific Gas and Electric, and San Diego Gas and Electric, the big electric power utilities that are private corporations, their credentials are all almost exactly the same. They have a bachelor's degree in engineering, maybe a master's degree in engineering, maybe also an MBA. They have sort of dual engineering and finance training and background. And they've been working in utilities for 30 years. You become the CEO of Southern California Edison or Pacific Gas and Electric maybe 25 years after you start out as an associate engineer in the engineering department at that utility. And when you go look at the credentials of people who run community choice aggregators, which are supposed to be electric power utilities, the director, the founder of Marin Clean Energy, who now runs a different community choice aggregator, was a city council member in Mill Valley. She was a federal banking regulator. She was a consultant to nonprofit social justice corporations that do low-income housing. The director of Marin Clean Energy Now, MCE, was a social justice and environmental justice activist who did labor organizing. The director of the Clean Power Alliance in Los Angeles, the largest community choice aggregator with, you know, almost $1.6 billion a year in income, has a degree in architecture and worked on Eric Garcetti's political staff and was an adjunct professor at a public policy school. So none of them have, I think there's one exception that I found, but the people who are running these giant supposed electric power utilities that don't generate or transmit or deliver any electric power, they all have communications degrees and things like that, political science degrees, organizer backgrounds, political staff backgrounds. And if you go start looking around, Corey Jackson, we have a $73 billion budget deficit in California. And the assembly has appointed a special committee to find ways to close the budget deficit. Corey Jackson is on that committee on the basis of the fact that he has a fake doctorate in social work and he ran a fake nonprofit that brought in $3 million a year of free government money to do social justice organizing. Now he's in charge of a budget of hundreds of billions of dollars. If you look around, the thing that happened in the Cultural Revolution in China is that political cadre showed up at places like dams and power plants and said, you are not producing electricity in proper ideological, in a, you know, a proper ideological way. We're taking over this power plant and producing proper Maoist electricity. And political cadre took over infrastructure and the sort of basic building blocks of society.
And you're going to say that the economy flourished right afterward.
Yes. And China just exploded and had just wonderful prosperity. It was great for everybody. And I think we're doing a very subtle, slow motion version of the same thing. We're taking people who come from the political class and putting them in charge of the real stuff. We're taking Pete Buttigieg and putting him in charge of airplanes. And you see how it's working.
We speak, you and I do, on the morning that a cargo ship untethered from tugboats crashed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore. We could go on. So I wonder, let's take this back to you. You are a former reporter, as you say, and now you've got this Substack account. And I'm wondering, you know, so people can find you there. What? Tell us a little bit about your Substack and when you started it and what you do. I want to thank you for this. You do yeoman's work for California. And I, you know, that as, you know, one of the co-hosts of Radio Free California, I'm kind of into this thing. And as president of the California policy, I love anything about California. So is this what we can expect from you going forward? Is that you'll keep focusing on the chaos here in the Golden State?
You know, I get emails from people, from readers. I have readers all over the world. And I get emails from them from time to time saying, like, please don't post about California again this week. But one of the things I say is that anything that you see happening in California is happening everywhere. The degree to which we're creating a single party state where we're delegitimizing dissent or disagreement or alternative visions of the world, the degree to which we're politicizing all forms of discourse. California is just the most naked and obvious of all of that stuff. But it's happening everywhere. There's another Substack writer who uses the name Eugypius, who's been writing about the German government, warning that you know, dangerous extremism is on the rise, and we need to take control of this dangerous extremism. And what he's showing is they're using the legislative and regulatory environment to make it illegal to disagree with them.
Mm.
And I think that's happening everywhere. I think it's happening in California. It's happening in Germany. It happened in New Zealand and Australia during the pandemic. It certainly happened in Canada. I think the similarities between the Canadian political environment and the California political environment are striking. The similarities between Justin Trudeau's political instincts and Gavin Newsom's political instincts are increasingly interesting. So I'm going to keep writing about California. It's not the only thing I write about, but I'm writing about California not to tell you about California even necessarily, but to tell you to look around you in the world and see what kinds of political instincts are percolating under the surface, to see what kinds of foundational premises are going on underneath our politics. And this world that we're developing of multi-billion dollar electric power utilities run by social justice organizers speaks to a thing that is happening all over the world and that is becoming very dangerous.
That's reporter Chris Bray. You can find his work on Substack, and you'll find links to that Substack account in the show notes here. Chris, thanks so much for joining us. That's all we have time for today. Thanks for spending your time with us. You can always find Radio Free California on the National Review website, but it would be easier for you and far better for us if you subscribe. And of course, rate and review the show wherever you do subscribe, because that boosts our profile and that helps other people find and join this little band of brothers and sisters. You can email us your comments and story suggestions. You'll find all our email addresses and other fun details in the show notes. On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson and Chris Bray, we give thanks, as ever, to session producers Lucas Klaus, Brian Tong, Glenn Hall, and National Review podcast producer Sarah Schutte. Thanks also to Metalachi, that's the LA-based mariachi and metal band, for our music. La Revolución continúa en la semana próxima.